يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello and welcome to Middle East Analysis, our second Middle East Analysis of the year, and it can't have escaped you if you're watching this that we're doing things a little bit differently today. Yes, it's Middle East Analysis on Vimeo, on YouTube, online. Now, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, our regular studio guest, as we look at all things in the Middle East, North Africa region. Things move at the rate of knots, so our topic to start with is Egypt, Harry. Tell us a little bit about what's going on. We've had a state of emergency. We've had death sentences handed down on the football rioters in Port Said. Bring us up to date.
Well, first of all, let me also greet our listeners and our viewers this time, James, and say that it is wonderful that we're trying to do a Vimeo attempt for the first time round. It's interesting, and I know how busy you are. I know how busy we all are. So this is quite an interesting test balloon that we're floating. The first political balloon that we will float today, I suspect, is, as you said, Egypt. And the interesting thing about Egypt, which is equally a worrying thing, is that 25th of January 2011 is when the revolution, if we are to call it a revolution, started in Egypt, which led to the downfall of President Hosni Mubarak and everything else that happened since then, with the election of a new president, with a new parliament that is non-functioning, with all the challenges against the judiciary, the police, the military, the SCAF. So in a sense, we've had two very turbulent years. And today we have entered into the second anniversary of the revolution. And while some people might have expected things to settle down a bit, the dust will settle down and we'll begin having some sense of where we're going in Egypt as one of the big players in the Middle East, North Africa, what we are actually witnessing are demonstrations, huge demonstrations in different parts of the country. In Cairo, the capital, of course, but also in the Suez Canal area. So we're talking about Port Said, we're talking about Ismailiye, we're talking about Suez itself. And what is happening is that all those protesters are out in the streets in different parts of those cities, protesting against the government, against the president. And that's the irony of it, because they protested against another president whom they basically got rid of, and now they're not happy with the new one. There are confrontations between the military and the police forces on the one hand and some of the demonstrators. There are differences of opinion, serious political differences of opinion between the National Salvation Front, which is the grand label for the opposition parties, and the Muslim Brotherhood and those in power with the president. So in a sense, it's a very uncertain period, a very dangerous period, because if things go out of control, then Egypt is a very important country and it will affect the whole region dramatically. But the good thing in terms of our viewers and listeners today is that nobody can predict what the uncertainty will lead to in the days and weeks ahead. So in a sense, we can make this conversation as long or as short as you choose it to be.
Well, I'll butt in on that score. I mean, you 3 decades of Mubarak. I mean, is it somewhat inevitable that whoever, President Morsi, whoever else might have come in instead, they would have faced this backlash? It wouldn't have been plain sailing, would it?
They would have faced the backlash. Whoever had come in as president would have had problems. In fact, when elections were taking place, there were 2 candidates, President Morsi, who was considered as the candidate of the Muslim Brotherhood and therefore an Islamist background, and then there was somebody with a secular military background who lost the election. So in a sense, you're right. But on the other hand, what has happened is that the country is now deeply polarized between 2 camps, literally, perhaps even more than 2, but let's, for the sake of simplicity, city, say, two camps. On the one hand, you have the Muslim Brotherhood and the Salafist Islamist parties, which are supporting the president. And then you have others such as Al-Baradi, such as Sabahi, such as Amer Musa, such as Badi'i, such as the Waft party, all those other people, Ayman al-Nur, all those people who are basically looking for a more secular form of governance in Egypt rather than a more religious top-down form of government. And I think this is where the conflict is at the moment. But the conflict is not only on issues of religion. It's on issues of principle, and it's on issues of how to run Egypt itself. It's on the dissatisfaction of different wakes of society. And when you have a demonstration, it's not always a principle demonstration where you have people with clear political agendas going out in the streets. You also have hooligans and thugs who are just out there to destroy and create havoc. That's also taking part in those demonstrations as well. But it is a difficult situation and a moment because so many people have died, and that's not good. Okay, it pales into insignificance in a sense, if I want to be very cruel, with the almost 70,000 who've died in Syria. But yet, every human being is a life lost. And in Egypt, where the revolution was pretty much without many lives being lost, this is a huge event happening at the moment. And the key question is, would the two camps, if we call them two camps, would they manage to come together? Would they manage to find a compromise, or would they not find a compromise? It is in the interest of Egypt as an idea, as a country, forget the government, forget the ideologies behind it, as a country, would those two be able to come together, sit around a table and say, look, we're going to get this right? Or are they so suspicious of each other's ideas and agendas that this will not happen, which will tear the country even more apart? And that is not good for Egypt. It's not good for the MENA region. And incidentally, it's not good for us in the West either.
Why is that? Why is it not good for us in the West specifically?
Because we have strategic interests in Egypt. Those strategic interests, for instance, all the movement that's happening in the Suez Canal, that is very important. And a lot of the demonstrations are happening around about there. It's also very important for us because Egypt and Israel have a peace treaty. And it is very important that that peace treaty does not completely collapse, because that would lead to another issue. It is important for us because in the midst of all those uncertainties, you also have the Coptic communities, Christian communities, who are also part and parcel of Egyptian society and are also suffering just as everybody else. So in a sense, it is important for Egypt as a leader in the Arab world, as a country that has a say, not to come apart. I don't think it will come apart. I mean, it's always dramatic, the pictures we see. It's always dramatic, some of the reporting we get from places of confrontation, such as in Egypt. But it's not all. For instance, even in Cairo, even in Ismailia, even in Port Said, even in Suez, yes, there are areas which are very volatile, but there are other areas where people are continuing their lives, going out to have their nergiles and their coffees. So in a sense, it's a question of, is President Morsi, and I'll put it very plainly, James, and I think that pretty much carries the whole idea, is President Morsi willing and able to be the president of all Egypt, or is he the president only of one faction of Egypt, which is the Muslim Brotherhood or the Islamist parties? If we can resolve this, and if we can make the president a president of the whole country, which means he has to adopt some of the agendas of the opposition, such as on secular values, such as on women's rights, such as on freedom of expression, such as on freedom of the press, then we are talking. Otherwise, we're in trouble.
And then from a Christian perspective, I have to ask you this. Where do the Coptic Orthodox sit in this current picture, this emergency state?
Well, I think at the moment, the issue is much bigger than the Coptic Orthodox community. The Coptic Orthodox are important, but they are not the most important factor in this. At the moment, we have two basically camps who are at loggerheads. And in that sense, the Coptics, we shouldn't give the Coptic community and the Copts, whether Orthodox, Catholic or Evangelical, far more importance in terms of how they're defining society or fitting within it than they actually have. However, I would say that the Copts in general, and they now have the Orthodox Church there, has a new Pope as well, Pope Tawadros II. If we are going to look at them particularly, I would say that they're as worried about freedom of worship, as worried about creeping Islamism, as worried about this sense of retrenchment and isolation as anybody else. And there are movements that suggest Egyptian Copts are leaving the country, are emigrating, and Egypt is one of the few countries in the Middle East and North Africa where Christians have not actually emigrated out of the country because of their rootedness into their own country, in other words, Egypt, even though those might well be true. But there are about 8 to 10 million Copts at the very least in Egypt, so it is a large demography, and that demography, in my opinion, is also part of the geography and therefore part of the politics of the region.
Now, I'm going to take a little time out now just to remind you of a few web addresses. You can find the home of Middle East Analysis online at catholicnews.org.uk, and you can also find Middle East Analysis on iTunes if you prefer to get your podcast that way. Just search for Harry Hagopian there. Harry is on Twitter, and that's at Harry Hagopian, and we too are on Twitter, Catholic Church, at Catholic EW. Now, Harry, you talk about the importance of Egypt and the ramifications of a destabilized situation in that country. Now, let's move on to Israel-Palestine, because, of course, the shockwaves from that particular reality are felt the region over as well.
Over the elections.
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Just bring us up to date, because I'm certainly not an expert, but the Israeli elections were somewhat surprising, were they not?
The Israeli elections were surprising in the sense that the results were not those that were expected. Everybody had thought that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman, when they basically merged their two movements, Likud and Yisrael Beiteinu, that they would have a very strong presence in the parliament, and that with one or two other factions, Netanyahu could carry on with his policies. However, as the election time drew nearer, people started talking of another movement, Bayit Yehudi, which is the Jewish house, and that was with Naftali Bennett. And people thought, oh, he's even more right-wing and more extreme, if I can use those terms, than Netanyahu, and he was on the ascendant. However, the surprising results of the elections is that whilst Bennett got 11 seats, Likud Yisrael Beiteinu underperformed quite a bit, and in my opinion, Netanyahu ended up with a bloodied nose. They only got about 31 seats, but the star, the comet, and therefore the kingmaker of Israeli politics was Yair Lapid of Yesh Atid. Yesh Atid in Hebrew means there is a future. And indeed, the future at the moment, to a large extent, as to the configuration of the next government and the policies that the next government would pursue, most probably under the prime ministership of Netanyahu still, depends on who would be the groups that would come together to form the cabinet. Would it be, for instance, Netanyahu with Lapid and with Bennett, or would it be with the ultra-Orthodox and religious parties? Would it be other parties from the center which would come in as well? Kadima has a couple of seats there. Hatnua, which in Hebrew means movement, with Tzipi Livni, also has seats there. How is it going to happen? And to dramatize, James, a little bit what is happening, I read somewhere in one of those myriad reports that are coming out of Israel at the moment, is that what we are witnessing, and I want to quote it, so forgive me if I look at my paper, we are witnessing an ideological contest over the soul of Israel and the Jewish people. Big drama. Really weighty words. I wouldn't go that far, but I would say that Yair Lapid, who is a journalist himself and who won those 19 seats, and therefore he has become a kingmaker in terms of what happens next, he carried his election under the slogan sharing the burden. And the idea was that everybody should share the burden, the economic burden, the military burden, the political burden of the country, and not only the secular forces, but also the religious forces, which until now have been spoilt rotten under Israeli political systems.
The burden of the relationship with Palestine?
Not really. More the burden within Israeli society itself. For instance, how much money do the religious institutions get from the budget of the government? For instance, would all religious yeshiva students and Haredi religious men, would they be exempt, for instance, from serving in the army and from being drafted? These are questions that are very, very important given the economic moment where we're standing in Israel as to the future of that country. Hence the soul and the future of the Jewish people is how it is being portrayed, and hence his slogan, sharing the burden, which is everybody has to chip in. You can't just have one part of society doing all these things and the other part not doing it. However, having said that, it is also very important to say that in this internal rearranging of musical chairs, as it were, around the table, there are two very important cards. One is Iran and what happens to Iran. And secondly, and in my opinion, existentially, is what happens to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And would this new cabinet, given who Yair Lapid is, his background, the people who were elected on his list, would they push the agenda of a two-state solution forward, or would they be obstructionist, increase the settlements, make the two-state solution even less plausible and possible, and therefore lead to a disaster for everybody, and in my opinion, the isolation of Israel and the extinction of the Palestinian dream?
I think it is a time will tell, isn't it, on
that question? It is where a time will tell. It is a time to dream, but remember, dreams could be very nice, but they could also turn into nightmares.
Harry Hagopian, thank you very much for joining us to talk about two exceptionally weighty issues. And as I say, time will tell, and we will be back in the studio to analyse these issues and more. Dr. Harry Hagopian, thanks for joining us on Middle East Analysis.
My pleasure, James.
And again, I am going to reiterate, you can catch us on Twitter at CatholicEW. You can catch Dr. Harry Hagopian on Twitter as well, at Harry Hagopian. And the home of Middle East Analysis, just to remind you, is catholicnews.org.uk.
And it is a pleasure again to try this Vimeo experience today. I hope it works. And as we think of Israel, Palestine and Egypt, let us also think of other countries which are coping with the massive influx of refugees from Syria. And I mean countries like Lebanon, like Jordan primarily, who do not even have the financial wherewithal to deal with the hundreds of thousands of people that are flocking out of the country, let alone the millions who are displaced in the country itself.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much.
Pleasure, James.